Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how a plant extract shows promise in treating pancreatic cancer from Texas Tech University Health Sciences. We're also going to explore how early diet of infants, not maternal obesity, influences development of the gut microbiome. That's from the National Food Institute in Denmark. We're also going to look at the daily dose of beetroot juice, just beet juice, and how it can improve endurance and blood pressure. Wake Forest Medical Center. Also, vitamin D-rich foods during pregnancy may reduce allergy risk in children. That's a big deal. Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Also, today we'll explore, could the food we eat affect our genes? A study suggests this may indeed be the case. Cambridge University in the United Kingdom. I mentioned the universities, I mentioned the peer-reviewed literature because, on the one hand, there are those who believe that none of this is real. If you listen to some of the people on the major talk shows, they're giving you only one view, and that is the orthodox view, which they may believe, but they're wrong. We have over 500,000 studies showing the chemistry, the potency, the efficacy, the safety of vitamins and minerals alone. Thousands upon thousands of studies on the power of positive thinking, exercise, stress management, and healthy diet. And because these are independent studies, meaning they're not backed by any particular financial interest, they have more credibility. So on the one hand, there are people say, well, if it was based on good science, I might consider it. Everything we share on this program is based upon good science and has for decades. And so, at least for the physicians, the nurses, the scientists, the educators who listen, who want quality information that is verifiable, that has a sense of scholarship, that's what you receive every day. Also today, we're going to take a look at, from Les Leopold, from Alternet, the idea that Hillary Clinton took $200,000 to $400,000 per speech from banks and corporations is obscene. Why? Because no one is talking about what did those banks do. They're only looking at whether or not she deserved this, you know, the speaking fee. Well, there's another side to this story. I'll lay that out for you. Brand new information today that adds on to what we started the other day about the virus that is causing microcephaly, and that is the Zika virus. Some Brazilian and Argentinian doctors now believe it is the larvicide. That's a very powerful chemical agent. Oh, by the way, that was made by one of Monsanto's subsidiaries that has been sprayed in the water supply. So from our public health segment, I'll show you another piece of the puzzle that brings us a little closer to understanding why for 70 years there were no birth abnormalities with those infected with the Zika virus, and suddenly all at once there are. Well, it doesn't make sense unless we see more fully what those people were exposed to. Today we will. A commentary today from Dan Fromkin and Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept. The GOP candidates compete over who will commit the most war crimes once elected. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll read a piece of it, then I'd like for you to respond in our talkback segment. Also today, my guest will be Glenn Ford. Glenn is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. He is the son of the famed disc jockey Ruby the Deuce Rutherford, the first black television host to have a non-gospel radio program in the Deep South. And in the 1970s, he was a correspondent and journalist covering Capitol Hill in the White House for the Mutual Black Network. Later hosted the nation's first syndicated black news interview program, America's Black Forum. Since then, Glenn has been one of the nation's leading voices in political and social analysis and commentary on current affairs in the African-American community. He's also the founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists. And we're going to talk about Clinton wooing the Black Caucus leadership and how much are the Clintons a benefit to the African-American community. I will also be reading Michelle Alexander's The Nation magazine piece on why Hillary Clinton does not deserve the black vote. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. As anyone who listens to this program knows, I advocate a healthy, organic, wherever possible, locally grown, plant-based diet. That includes all the essential oils that you would get from eating walnuts and avocados and flax seeds and other plants, high in fiber, and rich in polyphenols, especially if you include all the fresh fruits that are available. This has been supported by an article in the peer-reviewed journal Scientific Reports. This is from Texas Tech University Health Sciences. Quote, a natural extract derived from India's neem tree, that's N-E-E-M, neem, could potentially be used to treat pancreatic cancer. Biomedical scientists at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso tested nimbolide, N-I-M, nim, bo, b-o, lide, l-i-d-e. Write that down, because if you know someone suffering from pancreatic cancer who is not improving under current therapy, this may be an important adjunct to that therapy. Again, nimbolide is N-I-M, B-O-L-I-D-E. It's a compound found in the neem leaves, and it's terrific against pancreatic cancer cell lines and mice. The results revealed that the nimbolide can stop pancreatic cancer's growth and metastasis without harming normal healthy cells. That's nothing like that can be done within orthodox medicine. Quote from the article, the promise nimbolide has shown is amazing, and the special use of the treatment towards cancer cells over normal cells is very intriguing. And that's from the associate professor at the center. Well, we know that pancreatic cancer has the highest death rate of all cancers. 94% of patients die within 5 years of diagnosis. The cancer grows quickly, and there are currently no effective orthodox treatments available, underscoring the importance of finding new therapies. However, I might say that I knew very well for many decades on a professional basis. He was not a close personal friend, but he was a professional friend. We spoke many, many times. I filmed him many times. He was on this radio program many times. Nicholas Gonzalez. And Nicholas had the best treatment for pancreatic cancer that I'm aware of in the United States. So, and his treatment continues. And if you need, he passed this year of a heart attack. But you can, there's another physician, a woman in his office who carries on the therapy. There were a couple other people who had some good results. The Dr. Joseph Issels had good results of pancreatic cancer, and Dr. Lawrence Burton. And Burton's work continues in Freeport, Grand Bahamas, at the center there, Immunization Research Center. So there are some places that have had some success, not great success. But I remember being over to Dr. Rivisi's office, and I had an enormous amount of respect for Rivisi. I considered him the Louis Pasteur of the 20th century. And I spent tens of thousands of hours with that man, talking, doing research projects together. And I personally interviewed over 1,500 patients who were five-year-plus survivals, all who had terminal cancer. And one sticks out in particular. He was an MD, PhD. He came from a very prestigious medical school where he taught. And he had pancreatic cancer and brain cancer. And his orthodox therapy had failed. And with no hope of surviving, he went to see Dr. Rivisi. Now, Rivisi was orthodox in every respect. He was not a holistic doctor, was not alternative, was not complementary. He was as orthodox as you get, but he just happened to have created some very unique inventions within orthodoxy that that help patients live. Diet, he knew nothing about diet, nothing at all. But he was very good at turning on and off cancer pain. He created the notion of anabolic-catabolic reactions. So if you had an anabolic pain, he would give you a catabolic agent, and if you had a catabolic pain, he would give you an anabolic action. So he was able, I watched it within minutes of him turning off excruciating pain, and one of the most excruciating pains is stomach cancer, but pancreatic cancer is right there beside it. And this doctor was one. And it was during my follow-up where I was interviewing these people to see, did Rivisi have a legitimate therapy? Because orthodoxy had been attacking him ceaselessly for a long time. Here's what the doctor told me, that he was now in his third year of being cancer-free. He came in twice a year to see Dr. Rivisi to see if he needed to change anything. And I said, well, you're an MD, you're a PhD, you're a professor, you're in a major Ivy League school. Why don't you go forward and let people know? Why don't you write up your story? He said, if I did that, I would be attacked. I've seen what they've done to him and other people of less quality and character. I am not that brave person. I'm not a hero. I would not be able to survive. I said, survive what? You had terminal cancer, brain and pancreas. You have neither in your body. You have medical records to prove it. There was no other therapy you had when your orthodox therapy failed you. You have been on this protocol for 5 years. You've been cancer-free for 3. This would hold some weight to at least allowing an objective study to be done. He said, no, it wouldn't. The last thing anyone wants in science is the truth, unless it's their truth. That's what he told me. He said, you're young and you're naive, and that's fine. But once you get a certain age and you see the world for what it is, you realize how little truth exists anywhere. I just thought he was having a bad day. I would later find out that he had far more truth in his statements, and he was right. I was young and I was naive, and I still believe that if you had something that would work, there'd be people in this world that would open themselves up to it. It's simply not true today, and it wasn't true then. Any human being who comes forward with any treatment that works but is not orthodoxy, cannot be patented, cannot be proprietized, it will not be accepted. Not only will it not be accepted, there's a high probability that the person bringing it forward will be attacked. I wished it were otherwise. And this just triggered that thought in my mind when I was reading this statement from this journal about how, gee whiz, something as simple as the neem leaves. And yet, I doubt you'll see anything on this cancer, even though it's a peer-reviewed journal, done at a major institution, and has full credibility. Quote from the study, nebulide seems to attack pancreatic cancer cells from all angles, end quote. But if they can't patent it, that's the end of the story. But it's not the end of what you know. You now have information that you could get a compounding pharmacy to make you up some. We also know that what a mother eats does impact the developing fetus, and what a mother has in her body will come through, good or bad, toxic or beneficial, when she breastfeeds. Hence, a woman, I believe, should detoxify her body for at least 2 years before having a planned pregnancy. And that means a full, be as healthy as you can be. No vaccines, no alcohol, no chemicals, no drugs, nothing that is not able to be utilized positively by your cells. Then you're giving a reservoir of health and healing to your developing fetus. And then breastfeeding after that will give it natural immunity. This is from the National Food Institute in Denmark. This would be equivalent to our FDA. Quote, after the age of 9 months, the development of the infant gut microbiota is driven by the transition to family foods, not maternal obesity, according to results of a new study. The study was published in M-Sphere, and that is a journal of the American Society of Microbiology. Quote, our results reveal that the transition from early infant feeding to family food is a major determinant for gut microbiota development. Maternal obesity did not influence microbiota diversity or special taxon abundance during the complementary feeding period. Now, why is this important? Because the gut microbiota, biota, is simply gut bacteria. I want to make it simple. Good bacteria or bad bacteria, depending upon what you're eating. That's a very complex community of microorganisms that live in the digestive tract. And children are essentially born without microbes in their gut. It's sterile. And they are immediately colonized upon birth. The next several years are critical in establishing a person's endogenous gut microbiota. And later in life, the gut microbiota can change in response to factors like diet. And each adult has a very distinct gut microbiota. So here's the takeaway message. If you are giving a healthy diet through breastfeeding, and then the child starts to eat, give them only organic, wherever possible. And if it's not possible, then give them healthy and sprayed with a detergent that exfoliates off pesticides, and you can get about 98% of that removed. And how I wash everything is I spray it with a vegetable cleanser, rinse it, and then put it into a bowl, and you agitate it, meaning you put your hand in and you shake it as the water's filling up, and then you tip it over and empty it out, and then you do it 3 times. And then the 4th time, if you look and you can't see anything in the water, more often than not, that's you've got it all. That's the only way you're going to get really clean food. And then by giving your young developing child the healthy organic foods and combinations, that's building up a good gut bacteria. That means the child will be less susceptible to diabetes, heart disease, arthritis and inflammatory conditions, inner ear infections. So you have a chance to allow a child to develop the way nature meant. If, however, the child is eating French fries, colas, sugar desserts, bad bacteria, now you're going to have allergies, infections, skin conditions, scalp conditions, inflammation, bedwetting. By the way, bedwetting is a very common symptom of allergies to dairy. So clean up the gut. Also, from Wake Forest Medical Center, if we have a daily glass, 6 ounces, 8 ounces, of beet juice, that's going to improve your endurance and your blood pressure, and it's what I would suggest people take to work with them, and have yourself a glass of beet juice when everyone else is having a coffee break. Your blood sugar will be normalized, and you'll have much more energy. And this was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. So you need that. And that will help you, the good energy drink. And if a mother takes her vitamin D-rich foods or supplements, you're going to reduce allergy risk in children. That's from Mount Sinai School of Medicine. So that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I love you.
like to welcome all of you from our public health segment. This is from Claire Robinson from GM Watch. A report from the Argentine Doctors Organizations, entitled Physicians in the Crop-Sprayed Towns, challenges the theory that the Zika virus epidemic in Brazil is caused by an increase in birth defect microcephaly among newborns. The increase in this birth defect, in which the baby is born with an abnormally small head and often has brain damage, has quickly linked to the Zika virus by the Brazilian Minister of Health. However, according to the physicians in the Crop Spray Town group, the ministry failed to recognize that in the area where most sick people live, a chemical larvicide that produces malformations in mosquitoes was introduced into the drinking water supply in 2014. This poison is used in a state-controlled program aimed at eradicating disease-carrying mosquitoes. The physicians added that the chemical is manufactured by the Sumimoto Chemical Company, a Japanese subsidiary of Monsanto. The chemical is a growth inhibitor of mosquito larvae, which alters the development process from larva to the adult, thus generating malformations in developing mosquitoes and killing or disabling them. It acts as an insect juvenile hormone, or juvenoid, and has the effect of inhibiting the development of adult insects' characteristics, for example, wings and mature external genitalia, and reproductive development. It's an endocrine disruptor, and it's teratogenic, and meaning it causes birth defects. And the Argentine physicians commented, quote, malformations detected in thousands of children from pregnant women living in areas where the Brazilian state added the chemical to drinking water are not a coincidence, even though the Ministry of Health places a direct blame on the Zika virus for this damage, end quote. They also noted that Zika has traditionally been held to be a relatively benign disease that has never been associated with birth defects, even in areas where it infects 75% of the population. But the larvicide is the most likely culprit in birth defects. The chemical is a relatively new introduction to the Brazilian environment. The microcephaly increase is a relatively new phenomena. So the larvicide seems a plausible causative factor in the shrunken brains and skulls, which is far more so than GM mosquitoes, which some have blamed for the Zika epidemic and thus for the birth defects. There's no sound evidence to support the notion promoted by some sources that GM mosquitoes can cause Zika, which in turn can cause the microcephaly. In fact, out of 404 confirmed microcephaly cases in Brazil, only 17% tested positive for the Zika virus. The Argentine Physicians Report, which also addresses the dengue fever epidemic in Brazil, concurs with the findings of a separate report on the Zika outbreak by the Brazilian doctors and public health research organizations. And they named this chemical that they put in the drinking water as a likely cause of the microcephaly. It condemns the strategy of the chemical control of Zika-carrying mosquitoes, which it says is contaminating the entire environment, as well as people, and is not decreasing numbers of mosquitoes. The Abrasca group suggests that this strategy is in fact driven by the commercial interests of the chemical industry, which it says is deeply integrated into the Latin American Ministries of Health, as well as the World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization. So, there you have it, another piece of the puzzle. Now for our talkback segment. This is from The Intercept. I'll quote part of it, but you'll get the idea. Quote, at a rally in New Hampshire on Monday night, Donald Trump was criticizing Ted Cruz for having insufficiently endorsed torture. Cruz has said two nights earlier that he would bring back waterboarding, but not, quote, in any sort of widespread use, end quote, when someone in the audience yelled out that Cruz was effeminate. Cruz, in faux outrage, reprimanded the supporter, repeating the allegations for the assembled crowd. The spectacle of one Republican presidential candidate being identified as effeminate for failing to sufficiently endorse an archetypical form of torture exemplifies the moral state of the current race for the GOP nomination. The Republican candidates have seemingly been competing with one another over who would commit the gravest war crimes if elected. In recent months, one candidate or another has promised to waterboard, do a, quote, hell of a lot worse than waterboarding, repopulate Guantanamo, engage in wars of aggression, kill family suspected terrorists, and carpet bomb Middle Eastern countries until we find out if sand can grow in the glow in the dark, end quote. The over-the-top bombast plays well in front of self-selected Republican audiences. The crowd responded to the description of Cruz Monday night with full-throated chants of Trump, Trump, Trump. But such promises of future criminality from potential presidential nominees have outraged many legal experts. Quote, torture, indiscriminate killing of civilians, and indefinite detention are clear violations of international domestic law, Haina Shamsi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project. Cruz not only called for the reinstitution of waterboarding during Saturday's presidential debate, but actually justified the practice using language reminiscent of the infamous 2002 Bybee memo authorized by disgraced former Justice Department John Yeo. The Texas senator, who had previously said that, quote, torture is wrong unambiguously, period, the end, was asked if waterboarding qualified as torture and responded, quote, well, under the definition of torture, no, it's not. Under the law, torture is excruciating pain that is equivalent to losing organs and systems. So under the definition of torture, it is not. It is enhancing interrogation. It is vigorous interrogation, but it does not meet the generally recognized definition of torture, end quote. But Yu's definition is absolutely not the law. His torture memos, written by Vice President Dick Cheney to provide legal cover for clearly illegal acts, were later rescinded and repudiated by the Bush administration itself for being barbaric, legally unsupported, and unreasonable. Quote, this question regarding whether waterboarding is torture is not arguable, said staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Now, here's the issue. This is not just the Republicans. Keep in mind that even Bernie Sanders has asked publicly for the Saudis to become more in charge of what goes on in the Middle East, in the conflicts, especially with Syria. You do not find a more repressive regime on the planet than the Saudis and their full embrace of Wahhabism. And where I certainly support Bernie Sanders on minimum wage, on women's rights, on gay rights, on not supporting the big banks if they get in trouble, of saying no to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and many other issues that I believe he is on the right side of history and the right side of helping the people. His foreign policy is a complete unmitigated disaster, as his support for Vermont for the C-35 plane, which is now approaching $2 trillion for a worthless boondoggle, but it sure has benefited the military-industrial complex. And also Hillary Clinton, not once during her husband's presidency, which was her co-presidency, not once as Secretary of State, did she challenge those regimes like Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, that were overtly Kuwait, that were overtly engaged in torture, or for that matter, beheadings. So it's just this whole idea that people are trying to show who's got the biggest muscles, who is the most barbaric, who is the most lethal, who is the most aggressive, who is the most willing to do whatever it takes to appease the crowd. And then who is this crowd? What does it say about these people, these Americans, needing someone to engage in blood sport as their primary option? That's our question. What does it say about the quality, the character of the people who have become the most powerful person in the world? And the media is not touching this. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. That's our question. Now, I'm going to read to you a commentary from Michelle Alexander, and then we're going to go to Glenn Ford. This is from The Nation, and it's entitled, Why Hillary Clinton Doesn't Deserve the Black Vote. Hillary Clinton loves black people, and black people love Hillary, or so it seems. Black politicians have lined up in droves to endorse her, eager to prove their loyalty to the Clintons in the hopes that their faithfulness will be remembered and rewarded. Black pastors are opening their church doors, and the Clintons are making themselves comfortably at home once again, engaging effortlessly in all the usual rituals associated with courting the black vote, a pursuit that typically begins and ends with Democrat politicians making black people feel liked and taken seriously, doing something concrete to improve the conditions under which most black people live, in generally, is not required. Hillary's looking to gain momentum on the campaign trail as the primaries move out of Iowa and New Hampshire and into states like South Carolina, where large pockets of black voters can be found. According to some polls, she leads Bernie Sanders by as much as 60% among African Americans. It seems that we, black people, are her winning card, one that Hillary is eager to play. And it seems we're eager to get played again. The love affair between black folks and the Clintons has been going on for a long time. It began back in 1992 when Bill Clinton was running for president. He threw on some shades and played the saxophone on Arsenio Hall show. It seems silly in retrospect, but many of us fell for that. At the time when a popular slogan was, "It's a black thing and you wouldn't understand," Clinton seemed to get us. When Toni Morrison dubbed him our first black president, we nodded our heads. We had our boy in the White House, or at least we thought we did. Black voters have been remarkably loyal to the Clintons for more than 25 years. It's true that we eventually lined up behind Barack Obama in 2008, but it's a measure of the Clinton allure that Hillary led Obama among black voters until he started winning caucuses and primaries. Now Hillary is running again. This time she's facing a Democratic socialist who promises a political revolution that will bring universal health care, a living wage, an end to rampant Wall Street greed, and the dismantling of the vast prison state, many of the same goals that Martin Luther King Jr. championed at the end of his life. Even so, black folks are sticking with Hillary's brand. What have the Clintons done to earn such devotion? Did they take extreme political risks to defend the rights of African Americans? Did they courageously stand up to right-wing demagoguery about black communities? Did they help usher in a new era of hope and prosperity for neighborhoods devastated by deindustrialization and globalization and the disappearance of work? No, quite the opposite. When Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992, black urban communities across America were suffering from economic collapse. Hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs had vanished as factories moved overseas in search of cheaper labor. A new plantation. Globalization and deindustrialization affected workers of all colors, but African Americans particularly hard. Unemployment rates among young black men had quadrupled as the rate of industrial employment plummeted. Crime rates spiked in inner communities that had been dependent upon factory jobs, while hopelessness, despair, and crack addiction swept neighborhoods that had once been solidly working class. Millions of black folks, many of whom had fled Jim Crow segregation in the South with the hope of obtaining decent work in northern factories, were suddenly trapped in racially segregated jobless ghettos. On the campaign trail, Bill Clinton made the economy his top priority and argued persuasively that conservatives were just using race to divide the nation and divert attention from the failed economy. In practice, however, he capitulated entirely to right-wing backlash against the civil rights movement and embraced former President Ronald Reagan's agenda on race, crime, welfare, and taxes, ultimately doing more harm to black communities than Reagan ever did. We should have seen it coming. Back then, Clinton was the standard bearer for the New Democrats, a group that firmly believed the only way to win back the millions of white voters in the South who had defected to the Republican Party was to adopt the right-wing narrative that black communities ought to be disciplined with harsh punishment rather than coddled with welfare. Reagan had won the presidency by dog-whistling to poor working-class whites with coded racial appeals, railing against welfare queens and criminal predators and condemning big government. Clinton aimed to win them back, vowing that he would never permit any Republican to be perceived as tougher on crime than he. Just weeks before the critical New Hampshire primary, Clinton proved his toughness by flying back to Arkansas to oversee the execution of Ricky Ray Rector, a mentally impaired black man who had so little conception of what was about to happen to him on his execution day that he asked for the dessert from his last meal to be saved for him for later. After the execution, Clinton remarked, quote, "I can be nicked a lot, but no one can say I'm soft on crime." Clinton mastered the art of sending mixed cultural messages, appealing to African Americans by belting out "Lift Every Voice and Sing" in black churches, while at the same time signaling to poor and working class whites that he was willing to be tougher on black communities than Republicans had been. Clinton was praised for his no-nonsense pragmatic approach to racial politics. He won the election and appointed a racially diverse cabinet that looked like America. He won re-election 4 years later, and the American economy rebounded. Democrats cheered. The Democratic Party had been saved. The Clintons won. Guess who lost? Bill Clinton presided over the largest increase in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history. Bill Clinton did not declare the war on crime or the war on drugs. Those wars were declared before Reagan was elected and long before crack hit the streets. But he escalated it beyond what many conservatives had imagined possible. He supported the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity of crack versus powder cocaine, which produced staggering racial injustice in sentencing and boosted funding for drug enforcement. Clinton championed the idea of a federal three-strikes law in his 1994 State of the Union address, and months later signed a $30 billion crime bill that created dozens of new federal capital crimes, mandated life sentences for some three-time offenders, and authorized more than $16 billion for state prison grants and the expansion of police forces. The legislation was hailed by mainstream media outlets as a victory for the Democrats, who were, quote, "were able to wrest the crime issue from the Republicans and make it their own." When Clinton left office in 2001, the United States had the highest rate of incarceration in the world. Human Rights Watch reported that in seven states, African Americans constituted up to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison, even though they were no more likely than whites to use or sell drugs that were illegal. Prison admissions for drug offenses reached a level in 2000 for African Americans more than 2,600% the level of 1983. All of the presidents since 1980 have contributed to mass incarceration, but as Equal Justice Initiative founder Brian Stevenson recently observed, quote, "President Clinton's tenure was the worst. Some might argue that it's unfair to judge Hillary Clinton for the policies her husband championed years ago, but Hillary wasn't picking out China while she was first lady. She was bravely broke the mold and redefined that job in ways no woman had ever been before. She not only championed for Bill, she also wielded power and significant influence once he was elected, lobbying for legislation and other measures. That record and her statements from that era should be scrutinized. In her support for the 1994 crime bill, for example, she used racially coded rhetoric to cast black children as animals." Quote from Hillary Clinton, "They're not just gangs of kids anymore. They're often the kind of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel." End quote. Both Clintons now express regret over the crime bill, and Hillary says she supports criminal justice reforms to undo some of the damage that was done by her husband's administration. But on the campaign trail, she continues to invoke the economy and country and that Bill Clinton left behind as a legacy that she would continue. So what exactly did the Clinton economy look like for black America? Taking a hard look at recent past is about more than just a choice between two candidates, about whether the Democratic Party can finally reckon with what its policies have done to the African American communities and whether it can redeem itself and rightly earn the loyalty of black voters. And then it goes on from there, but that's enough to get you into the state of consciousness that the Clintons were not helping the African-American community. And yet there are those right now in the Black Caucus in Washington and Al Sharpton and others who are racing to get beside her in all the photo ops. The Hill, quote, "Black Democrats are closing ranks around Hillary Clinton amid growing fears that Bernie Sanders poses a real threat to her presidential candidacy. The Congressional Black Caucus, PAC, this week voted to make its endorsement of Clinton official, and, quote, more than a dozen of the Congressional Black Caucus members will be storming South Carolina later this month to stump for her ahead of the state's February 27th Democratic primary. That said, let's bring in Glenn Ford. I've given you his bio earlier in the program. Nice to have you with us today, Glenn.
Thanks for the invitation, Gary.
Glenn, when we look at Bill Clinton's record in the White House, we can observe the long-term damage his administration did towards the black community. He escalated Reagan's war on drugs. There was his disastrous three strikes bill that incarcerated many people for what would be considered minor offenses. And there was a 90% of drug offenders in prison were African Americans. When he left office, he did very little to enable more African Americans and minorities, particularly from poor income families, to attend college. He slashed public housing. The jobless rate for non-college educated black men was 42% when Bill Clinton's term ended. And we can go on and on with how the Clintons have been anything but a champion for racial equality, equal opportunity, and raising up African-American living standards. So I find it personally outrageous that congressional black leaders will be descending upon South Carolina to try to secure the vote for Hillary Clinton in the next primary. Fortunately, there are plenty of black leaders who refuse to support Clinton, including yourself, but also Cornel West, Michelle Alexander, Representative Keith Ellison, Al Sharpton, Ben Jealous, and many African-American musical celebrities and others. So I'd like you to share with us your analysis based upon the record, how the Clinton Congressional Black Caucus Alliance that is taking shape is nothing more than, in my personal opinion, blatant hypocrisy. The forum is yours.
Well, first of all, I think that if, and of course, the Clinton presidency was an absolute disaster for black people, and everything that you've been talking about for the last several minutes is absolutely true. But I think that if we focus on Bill Clinton's particular talents, his snake oil salesman abilities, and his skills in being able to charm black preachers and charm black rank and file folks with his cultural appeals, if we look at that as being the main focus, we miss the larger picture. And the larger picture, the real reason that we have representatives of black folks in terms of black elected officials, but also black rank and file voters voting actually not just against their own interests, but against the core of progressive black politics. The reason that this occurs, that this huge paradox exists, that the most left-leaning constituency in the United States when it comes to Democratic Party national primaries tends to vote not for the most left-wing candidate, but for the more corporate candidate. We have to look at the structural problem here, and that is the two-party duopoly system. In the United States, we have two parties. Both of them are rich man's parties, but one of them is always a white man's party. That is a party whose organizing principle is white supremacy, and whether it's loudly as in previous eras or with dog whistles nowadays, lets everybody know that it's the white man's party. And under that kind of system, black folks feel compelled to put all of their political capital, all of their energies in the other party, the party that is not the white man's party. In this era, the white man's party is the Republicans. In previous eras, it was the Democrats. And that means that black folks rally around this Democratic Party as if the Republicans present an existential threat to black people, and instead of voting for the candidate in the Democratic Party that best reflects their progressive left-leaning political views on the economy, on issues in war, of war and peace. Black voters are corralled to support the Democratic candidate that they think will have the strongest showing against the Republican. And they do that even when the candidate is black, all things being equal. The reason that half of black voters and the vast majority of black elected officials did not support Barack Obama in 2008 until the Iowa primary was because they thought that Hillary Clinton would be the stronger candidate to defeat the Republicans. And it was not until Barack Obama won in the mostly white state of Iowa that black folks, including elected officials, went over to Barack Obama, who is ideologically identical with Hillary Clinton, but went over to Barack Obama wholesale because he had shown that he was could be a strong candidate gathering white voters against the Republican. So this two-party duopoly system has black folks locked in to the corporate candidate. Now, we at Black Agenda Report are not supporting Bernie Sanders. Sanders is, of course, to the left of Hillary Clinton, and we're pleased that his poll numbers are going up because that is an expression of people's of popular sentiment against Wall Street and against the corporations. And anybody on the left would be happy that there is such popular expression. The problem is that the Democratic Party is not the vehicle that is prepared or capable of challenging Wall Street because it is a rich man's party, just like the Republican Party. And that is what creates this contradiction. And when we have this contradiction, the worst elements of the black misleadership class come to the fore. And that's what we've seen with these this CBC PAC endorsement this week of Hillary Clinton. Three of those seven congresspersons who are part of the PAC, remember the PAC is not the same as the caucus, it raises money for the caucus, three of those congresspersons we documented in the Black Agenda Report's CBC Monitor report card, were the three black members of Congress who voted for TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. All the rest of the caucus voted against it. These are the worst, the most reactionary, the most right-wing members of the caucus. And in fact, Terry Sewell, who made the announcement this week in endorsing Clinton, was rated in the CBC Monitor report card as the worst member of the caucus. So not only are blacks corralled into this Democratic party, not only do they then support the corporate candidate, the candidate who usually has the most money, because they believe that that's the best shot at defeating the Republicans, which is seen as correctly the white man's party, but the most right-wing elements of the black misleadership class then become most prominent within black political groupings like the caucus itself. It pulls the whole black body politic, which is in terms of ideology the most left-wing constituency, it pulls it inexorably to the right. And that will happen whether you have a snake charmer like Bill Clinton running or his cold-as-ice wife running. It's the structure of the system that exists in the United States, the duopoly.
The Democrat establishment bases its sole argument on differentiating Hillary's strengths against their perceived use of Sanders' weaknesses as one of pragmatism versus idealism. And yet, what has the Clinton pragmatism and Obama's and the entire Democratic Party, which would include the Democratic Black Caucus for that matter, realistically and pragmatically contributed to improving the domestic state of the nation during the past 7 years? Essentially, nothing, in my opinion. So this is a faux argument. So what does this say about the effectiveness of the Black Caucus? And would you say that that any of them have sold out to the Democratic capitalists and elitist establishment?
Actually, we've documented that the Black Caucus has not drifted, but lunged to the right, especially since about 2005. You know, the Congressional Black Caucus always functioned based on consensus. And after its founding in 1970, and for the next 25 years at least, that consensus was a left consensus, at least relative to the rest of Democrats in Congress. You really could count on the Congressional Black Caucus being at the cutting edge of the left wing of Democrats on Capitol Hill during those days. And so they were able to, through consensus, be the progressive voice on Capitol Hill. All that started to dissolve around the turn of the 21st century. And since that time, the Congressional Black Caucus has not been able as a body to come out forcefully on any issue except the most basic ones like voting rights and aid to historically black colleges and universities. But on essential core economic issues, they've been scattered all over the place. They lack any kind of coherence. And the worst elements, the most eager sellouts, have had a free rein. There has not been any peer pressure within the caucus to rein in their most reactionary tendencies. And they tend to group in places like the CBC PAC, which is full of the worst of the caucus.
I appreciate you sharing these important insights with us, Glenn. Glenn Ford can be heard every Monday at 11 a.m. on the Black Agenda Report, and the blackagendareport.com is the website. Thank you very much, Glenn. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Closing out our program today, I just want to share some thoughts from Les Leopold of Aldernet. And he is saying, okay, so Hillary made all this money on Wall Street. Why? Why is that important? Well, because look at Wall Street's dirty deeds. One, the fines and settlements. Since 2009, Wall Street has paid $204 billion in fines and settlements. This is the equivalent of writing a $648 check to every man, woman, and child in America, including all undocumented residents. So that's a very flawed business model where you pay $204 billion in fines. And the unlawful acts include the facilitation of money laundering for drug cartels and rogue nations, illegally evicting homeowners, selling fraudulent mortgages and mortgage-backed securities, manipulating vital interest rates, insider trading, and facilitating offshore tax evasion. The damage done to homeowners and those who lost their jobs during the Great Recession is arguably far worse than the problems caused by drug trafficking. Yet millions, especially people of color, have been arrested, fined, convicted, and jailed through the failed war on drugs. Also, profits extracted through payday lending. Loan sharking is something from The Sopranos, but payday lending, the legalized form of loan sharking, is a mainstream Wall Street activity. Hillary Clinton's fully aware of this. An estimated 120 million payday loans are issued annually worth $42 billion. Now, here's what you got to understand, and Hillary knows this. One study said, quote, the average effective interest rate on a payday loan is 455%. For a loan of $300, a typical borrower pays an average of $775. $475 is interest and fees. And these are from the poorest. And yet these are the big banks. They're the primary people. Wells Fargo, Bank of America, U.S. Bank, J.P. Morgan, PNC Financial Services. Now, and they paid $225,000 to Hillary. And also, financial strip mining. Perhaps the most pernicious Wall Street activity involves corporate raids and stock buybacks. Hedge funds, private equity firms, and investment banks have bought up tens of thousands of corporations, loaded them up with debt, and then milked them dry. They're called unlocking value, but it's a cold, hard financial strip mining that adds no value at all to the target firms while squeezing the livelihood of the average employee. These Wall Street predators pressure corporations and by the thousands to use their revenues to buy back their own shares, thereby raising the share prices, enriching CEOs and the largest Wall Street investors. So the next time we hear about Hillary Clinton getting a big paycheck, yeah, she did. Would you get a paycheck? Would you even want to give a lecture before a group of such reprehensible, vile people? I don't think so. It shows you a lot about her character that she's willing to take massive amounts of money from people who are bad to the bone and are the enemies of everything that is decent, honorable, and spiritual in America. Enough said. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.